All right, hey everyone, ready to dive in. Today we're going to tackle some pretty intense biblical history. We're looking at two books, Kings and Chronicles, and here's the kicker. They both tell the story of the same events, but like from totally different angles.
Yeah, it's almost like watching a football game, you know?
Yeah.
You've got the same field, the same players, but one camera's zoomed in on the quarterback and the other's capturing the coach going crazy on the sidelines.
Exactly. So by the end of this deep dive, hopefully, we'll see just how much our viewpoint, you know, like the camera angle we're looking from, can totally change how we understand history.
It really makes you think about, like, who's telling the story and what they're trying to emphasize, you know? What are their priorities?
For sure. And today we're focusing on two kings from the southern kingdom, Judah, Rehoboam, and his son, Abijah. Now, this is after that whole kingdom split thing, which was like a huge turning point for the Israelites. One united kingdom, boom, splits in two. Total game changer.
Absolutely. I mean, Think about the political and theological implications of that. It sets the stage for everything that follows.
Right. And we're also going to compare these guys to Jeroboam and his son, who were ruling up north in the northern kingdom at the same time. Talk about family drama, right?
Oh, yeah. This period is like a powder keg of political intrigue and religious tension.
So let's get to our narrators, right? Kings and Chronicles. First up, Kings. This one's pretty straightforward. It's all about judging the kings. You know, were they good or bad in God's eyes? Did they let things like idolatry and pagan worship slide? Did they take care of the people who needed help? It's like a report card on their leadership.
It almost reads like a historical record, you know?
Yeah.
A chronicle of events, but with a very clear moral compass guiding the narrative.
Totally. But then you've got Chronicles, and this one's super interesting because it was written much later, after the Babylonian exile. Quick recap. The Babylonians conquered Judah, destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, took a bunch of Israelites captive to Babylon. Devastating time.
A real crisis of faith for the Israelites. It forced them to rethink everything they thought they knew about God, their identity, their future.
And that's where Chronicles comes in. Imagine everything you thought defined you as God's people, your land, your temple, your king, it's gone. So Chronicles is wrestling with this massive question. How can we still be the people of God without all those things?
Right. It's like, how do you hold on to your identity when everything that seemed to define it has been stripped away?
And their answer is worship. Chronicles is all about keeping the faith alive, focusing on the temple, the priests, the Levites, all those who kept the traditions going. It's like they're saying, okay, we might not have a king or a land right now, but we can still be connected to God through how we worship.
It's a powerful testament to the resilience of faith, how even in the face of loss and devastation, the human spirit can find ways to maintain hope and connection.
Okay, so let's bring in our first king, Rehoboam. Now, Chronicles actually paints a somewhat decent picture of him, gives him props for upholding the temple and all that.
Yeah. From Chronicles' point of view, that was paramount. Preserving the temple, the rituals, it symbolized the enduring covenant with God, a hope for a future restoration.
But Kings is not so impressed. It's like, hold up, Rehoboam. You might have personally followed the rules, but you didn't exactly stop all the bad stuff happening under your watch, did you? And remember, this whole mess kind of started with your dad, Solomon.
Yeah, Kings is really challenging Rehoboam's leadership, saying it's not enough to just be good yourself. You have to actively influence those around you, especially the people you're responsible for.
Right. It's a much bigger picture than just personal piety. And speaking of big pictures, remember how Solomon made that whole alliance with Egypt, marrying Pharaoh's daughter? Well, guess what happens during Rehoboam's reign? Pharaoh Shishak shows up, marches right into Jerusalem, and plunders the temple, the same temple Solomon built.
Oh, man. Talk about irony. It's like history repeating itself, coming back to bite them, you know?
Totally. What do you make of that? I mean, symbolically, is it some kind of divine retribution, the consequence of choices made generations ago?
I think it definitely raises those questions. It makes you think about the long-term consequences of our actions, individually and as a society. How the choices we make today can echo through time.
Okay, so there's this one detail about Rehoboam that just stuck with me. After Shishak takes off with all the gold from the temple, including these amazing gold shields, Rehoboam replaces them with bronze ones. And I'm like, really? That's your priority?
It's a curious detail, isn't it? Some scholars see it as a focus on outward appearances, you know, like trying to project an image of strength and power when things are falling apart underneath.
Right. Putting on a show. It reminds me of that quote, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Maybe Rehoboam is clinging to these empty rituals instead of actually dealing with the real problems in his kingdom.
It's definitely a possibility. The text doesn't explicitly spell out Rehoboam's motivations, but it does make you think about our own tendencies to prioritize outward appearances over genuine transformation. Like, what are the bronze shields we might be clinging to in our own lives? What are those empty rituals that are keeping us from really encountering God?
Ooh, that's a good one. All right, so what happens next? Let's move on to Abijah, Rehoboam's son. His name literally means, "My father is Yahweh," but even that doesn't shield him from some pretty harsh criticism in Kings. Seems like his heart wasn't fully in it when it came to God.
Yeah, Kings is pretty critical of Abijah. It points out this disconnect between his name, which invokes God, and his actions, which often contradict God's will.
It's like he's trying to coast on his family legacy, but his heart isn't really in it.
And the text is clear that a divided heart leads to a compromised life, you know? You can't fully follow God if you're holding back a part of yourself.
That is so true. And it's relevant for all of us, right? Like, we might talk the talk or go through the motions, but is our heart really in it? Are we holding back any part of ourselves from God?
That's the invitation here, to examine our own hearts and motivations. What might be preventing us from fully surrendering to God? What are we afraid of?
And yet, even with all his struggles, Abijah still gets a chance, a lamp in Jerusalem, as they call it, because of God's promise to David. It shows that even when we mess up, God's grace is still there.
Absolutely. Abijah's story shows us that God's faithfulness and mercy endure, even when we fall short. But it also underscores the importance of aligning our hearts with God's will, striving for wholeness and integrity in our lives.
Okay, so if we look at both Rehoboam and Abijah in Kings, we see this interesting pattern. They're introduced, they make choices, they face consequences, they die, and then their successor takes over. It's like this cycle, this constant pattern of life and death, rise and fall.
And that cyclical structure is super important. It reminds us that history repeats itself. We're not just isolated individuals making decisions in a vacuum. Our actions have ripple effects. They impact those around us and even future generations.
It's like we're all part of this bigger story, right? We inherit legacies and we create them. So that brings up a pretty big question for all of us. What about our legacies? What patterns are we setting in motion with our own choices? What will our story look like? Stay tuned, because we're going to get personal. It's kind of crazy to think about, you know? These ancient kings, their struggles, their decisions, they're not that different from us. We all face those same temptations, those pressures, those chances to make a real difference.
Yeah, the human experience really does transcend time, doesn't it? Mm. We're all grappling with those same fundamental questions of meaning, purpose, our relationship with God.
Totally. And we were talking about how the Babylonian exile really shaped the perspective of Chronicles. I mean, can you imagine losing everything? Your homeland, your temple, your king? That must have been absolutely devastating.
It was a defining moment for the Israelites. It really forced them to re-examine everything they thought they knew about God, their identity as his people, everything.
And yet, out of that devastation, that loss, comes this incredible message of hope. They realized that even without a physical kingdom or a temple, they could still be God's people. Their connection to God wasn't tied to a specific place or structure, but to their hearts, their faith, their commitment to the covenant.
It's a testament to the resilience of the human spirit.
Yeah.
Right? That ability to find meaning and hope, even in the face of unimaginable adversity. It challenges us to consider what really defines us, what remains constant, even when everything else is stripped away.
So we've talked about how Chronicles is all about finding hope and meaning in exile, but what about Kings? What's the main takeaway for us today?
I think Kings offers this, like, sobering reminder of the consequences of straying from God's path. It's a call to accountability, you know, to examine our actions and their impact on ourselves and others. Our choices matter. They have real-world implications, for good or for bad.
Right. It's not enough to just go through the motions, to have that outward form of religion without the inner substance. We have to actively choose to align our hearts and our actions with God's will.
Exactly. It's about genuine faith, not empty rituals. It's about that lived experience of faith that transforms us from the inside out. The kind of faith that motivates us to act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with God.
Which brings us back to Rehoboam and Abijah. They both had their flaws, their moments of weakness, but they also had glimpses of faithfulness. Even when they messed up, God's grace was still there.
Their stories are a good reminder that none of us are perfect. We're all a work in progress. God's love and mercy are available to all of us, even when we stumble. But it's not about using God's grace as an excuse to stay stuck in our patterns, you know. It's about receiving his grace as a catalyst for growth and transformation.
It's such a hopeful message. We don't have to be perfect to experience God's love and guidance. We just have to be willing to learn, to grow, to keep striving towards a deeper relationship with Him.
That striving, that willingness to engage with God's will, that's what really matters. It's what shapes our character, our choices, and ultimately our legacy.
So the practical takeaway from these kings isn't just about avoiding their mistakes. It's about actively pursuing a life of faithfulness, using our influence for good, making a positive impact on the world.
Precisely. It's about recognizing the patterns in our own lives, the choices we make, the consequences that follow. It's about learning from the past to create a better future, both for ourselves and for those who come after us.
You know, when we were talking about Rehoboam replacing those gold shields with bronze ones, it really got me thinking. We talked about how it could be interpreted as like prioritizing appearances over true devotion. But could there be another layer to that?
I'm curious. What are you thinking?
Well, what if it wasn't just about appearances? What if it was also about like trying to hold on to the past, to those symbols of power and glory, even when everything had changed? Kind of like clinging to a security blanket, even though it can't really protect you anymore.
That's an interesting perspective. It really speaks to that human tendency to cling to what's familiar, even when it's no longer serving us. We might hold on to old beliefs, old habits, even old relationships, even when they're hindering our growth. We see it all the time, don't we? People resisting change, even when it's necessary for progress.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And maybe that's part of what Kings is trying to show us, the danger of clinging to the past, holding on to those bronze shields instead of embracing the possibility of something new.
It's a powerful challenge, isn't it? To let go of what's no longer serving us, to embrace the unknown, to trust in God's guidance even when we feel uncertain. Think about the Israelites in exile. They had let go of so much, their land, their temple, their way of life. But in that letting go, they discovered a new depth of faith, a new understanding of what it meant to be God's people.
That's so true. Letting go is hard, but it can also be incredibly freeing. It opens us up to new possibilities, new ways of being, new depths of faith. Okay, so we've talked about the consequences of choices, the importance of genuine faith over empty rituals, the challenge of letting go of the past. But there's one more piece I want to explore, this idea of beginnings and endings. Both Rehoboam and Abijah's stories in Kings follow this like really distinct structure. Introduction, actions, consequences, death, successor. It's a cycle, you know, this constant pattern of life and death, rise and fall.
That structure is definitely intentional. It highlights that cyclical nature of human experience. It reminds us that while individuals may come and go, the consequences of their actions continue to ripple outward, shaping the world around them.
So it's not just about our own personal journeys, right? It's about the impact we have on others, on future generations. We're all part of something so much bigger than ourselves. We inherit legacies and we create them.
Exactly. Our lives are interwoven with the lives of those who came before us and those who will come after. It's humbling, isn't it? We're part of this grand tapestry of human history, and our choices, big or small, contribute to the overall pattern.
And that brings us to a pretty profound question. What kind of legacy are we building? What patterns are we setting in motion with our choices? What will our introduction, actions, consequences, death, successor story look like?
It's a question worth pondering, for sure. Are we perpetuating cycles of negativity? Or are we forging new paths of hope and healing? Are we leaving the world a little bit better than we found it?
I love that. It's not just about avoiding mistakes. It's about actively creating something good, something that will outlast us. It really is inspiring, though, right? To think that we like have this power to break free from those negative cycles and to, you know, actually create a legacy of hope and healing.
It is, yeah. It's empowering to realize that we're not just along for the ride, you know? We're active participants in this whole thing. Co-creating with God, even.
So how do we do it? How do we actually like start writing a new story for ourselves, for the world?
Well, I think the first step is awareness, yeah. Right? Being aware of those patterns in our own lives.
Like taking a step back and really looking at ourselves, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. What are the things that keep coming up over and over? Those choices we keep making, those consequences that always seem to follow. What are those bronze shields we're holding on to? You know, those empty rituals or maybe those outdated beliefs that are keeping us from experiencing the fullness of God's power in our lives.
So basically getting real with ourselves, figuring out where we need to grow, where we need to change, maybe even where we need to surrender and let God do his thing.
And then, you know, after awareness comes action. It doesn't have to be this huge, dramatic thing. Start with small steps, just consistent choices that move you in the direction you want to go.
So, like, trading in those bronze shields for something, I don't know, more real, more authentic.
Yes, exactly. Replace them with genuine expressions of faith, with acts of love, with choices that reflect what you truly believe in. What are things that light you up, the things that make you feel truly alive? Do more of those things.
Be the change, right? Okay, so we've got awareness, action, and community. Can't forget about that.
So important. We don't have to do this alone. We have God walking with us every step of the way. We are the wisdom of the Bible, and we have each other, a whole community of people who are on this journey with us, you know, people who can encourage us, challenge us, keep us going.
It's like having like a support system for our souls. Okay, so awareness, action, community. A pretty powerful combination, if you ask me.
And imagine if everyone like committed to this, to writing a new story, to breaking free from those ancient cycles of negativity and embracing a future filled with like hope, healing, peace.
I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. So as we wrap up this deep dive into Kings and Chronicles, I want to encourage you, don't just listen and forget about it. You know, let this be a starting point, a catalyst for change, for growth, for a deeper and more authentic way of living out your faith.
Yeah, go out there and write a new story.
We're rooting for you. And until next time, keep diving deep.